No, you tell it.
No, you.
I'm not telling it.
You should totally tell it.
Well, you should tell it.
No, you tell it. No, You Tell It is a series that switches up the storytelling. So each performer writes a true life tale and then, switching with a partner, performs the other person's story, giving everyone involved the chance to share their own stories and experience someone else's. Today's Two on Tuesday stories were recorded live on June 17th at Jimmy's Number 43 and feature two Know You Tell It alums who came back to kick off the summer by switching up fun, frightening, and for the first time ever, fiction stories. We opened up our special fiction edition show with an unsettling tale written by Jim Carroll that may keep you up at night wondering if, and more importantly, when, you will wake up. Read by Raquel Penzo, here is The Sleeping Season.
One of my favorite parts of Know You Tell It is that along with you guys hearing the story perform for the first time, the author is hearing their story perform for the first time. So we make them sit up on stage so that you can see them experience the joy that is hearing their story perform. Usually I sit with them, but tonight, you know, as Jim pointed out, no rules tonight. So I'm not sitting up here. Because I figured these are alums, they've been through it, you know how to do it. So stand up. Because the second fun part of Know You Tell It is that before we hear their partner perform their story, I like to ask the author a little question so we get to hear their voice. And, you know, what are these people all about that wrote this amazing story we're about to hear? So, Jim.
Yes.
Yes. My first question is a two-part question. And my first part is, how jet-lagged are you? Because I know that you flew back from England just to do our, I'm making this, you know, maybe not just to do our show, but just to do our show. You flew all the way back.
I did. Well, I got in yesterday at 8:30 at night, which was 1:30 in the morning, and I got up at 4:30 in the morning, which was a fine late 9:30 start for me. So it's late now.
And the second part of your question, now that it's late and we know how quick you are to answer,
what?
I think that you said in your bio that anytime somebody asked you about Jeopardy, you would talk about it. So I think that left you open to tell us about the fact that you were on Jeopardy.
I won $25,400 on Jeopardy. But it's 12 years ago now, so that's 12 years ago money, which is like $25,600 now. But it's awesome. Woo! Yes, I won one game and should have won the second game, but I got really cocky.
Did you just write down crazy things? Or how did you get
So the final Jeopardy on the first one was recent movies for 2003. And it was April when I went on, so it's the first quarter, so that's you can use all of this. And it was this 2003 Action Adventures opening credits were in Braille. And then they started the music. And this is after you wager, which, by the way, I totally screwed up my math because, as I learned, I can only do trivia or math, not both. And if the guy had, if the second place guy had gotten it right, he totally would have beaten me. But the music is going on, and the last little chord, that's when I realized, oh my God, it's Daredevil. And so at the and if you watch the show, you can literally see me go. And I go, what is Daredevil? At the dun dun dun, I got up for the bum bum, but yes, I got Daredevil, and I got I think $9,000 off of that question, and it put me in the, it gave me the win, beating a 4-time returning champion, who was a truck driver from Georgia. Poor Leonard.
Well, we're lucky that we don't have Leonard here, but we have Jim. And we're going to start off the evening with his story, The Sleeping Season, written by Jim Carroll and performed by Raquel Penzo.
The Sleeping Season. The first person was Mrs. Pelletier on March 17th. She was my teacher back when I was in the fourth grade. There seems to be a million different stories now, but Alicia Groves' mom said she was getting off a bus and collapsed. People thought it was an aneurysm. Ms. Groves was part of the ambulance crew that picked her up. At the time, Mrs. Pelletier was completely non-responsive. They called her name, slapped her, even poked her with a needle. Nothing. Ms. Grove said they figured the brain was gone, but her body was just too dumb to realize it was dead. That evening, there was a vigil at the elementary school. The second day, the doctors went on the local television calling it a coma. On the third day, she woke up in the hospital and asked for some water and oatmeal because she was just a little hungry. No one was really paying attention, though, because by that time, Miss Groves and five other people had collapsed. The sleeping sickness rips through the town. About half of us slept, and most people were out for 2 to 3 days. But there were exceptions. Miles Claxton was under for 5 whole days. But Mr. Carpenter was only asleep for a few hours. A few people made fun of him and said he just wanted to take a nap during work. Which might have been true if he hadn't shown one major symptom of the sickness. When you're asleep, nothing, not noise, not pain, not even drugs, can wake you up. By May 1st, everyone who was asleep was awake again. I didn't get sick at all, but Channel 12 set up a van in the town square, and I was on TV twice. Luckily, nobody died, but Mr. Schiller fell asleep while going down a flight of stairs and broke his leg in 3 places. He woke up with his leg in a cast and steel pins in his thigh bone and never felt it. The following months, the CDC came in and tested us for everything. Blood, piss, hair, the dust in our houses, our pets, even a pair of beavers that lived down by the reservoir. At the end of the day, we were told the same thing. We were normal. There was nothing weird in the soil, in the trees, in the air, or in us. The official government verdict was hysterical contagion, aka mass psychogenic illness, aka it's all in your heads. By that time, it was Halloween, and Mr. Schiller's leg had mostly healed, and people were content to put it past them. We're a pretty small town, and people who choose to live in small towns like them for the same reason the people who choose to leave small towns hate them. Nothing much changes. When things get exciting or new or, God forbid, different, small town people will hunker down, wait for everything to calm down, and then do their best to return to their pre-incident life. If that's impossible, if the thing that happened is too disastrous or too life-changing to forget, then we'll start to refer to it by when it happened. A nod not to the thing itself, but to the time it happened. Remember June of 94? Someone would say. God almighty, someone else responds. Then, having obliquely acknowledged the thing, they can go back to repressing how awful it was. On February 9th, almost 11 months after it happened, Mrs. Pelletier was teaching the multiplication tables when she felt dizzy. She called the main office and was talking to Miss Basso when she went under. She was asleep for 14 weeks, by far the longest of us all. Miles was out from March 12th to April 7th. I missed all of April, and Miles was double pissed. One, he missed March Madness, and two, I was out longer than he was. Jenny Sullivan was the last one. She slept from May 15th to July 3rd. Jenny had been elected prom queen in April, so they waited for her to wake up and held the dance just for her. She was still woozy, and CNN covered it. You can see me in the background when they interviewed Jenny and Kurt. Kurt was propping up Jenny, and she was still slurring her speech a little. But since she was nice and beautiful and still managed a smile that could light up the sun, and Kurt still managed to look like a dick, even when he was being gallant. About 85% of the town fell asleep that time. A few people came real close to dying, but again, we got lucky. One of the perks of knowing everyone's business is you know when people are missing. Ms. King fell asleep in her garden and was missing for 2 days. She had a pretty good case of hypothermia. Mr. Sutton was a truck driver. It took people 3 days to realize he was missing. They found him on the floor of his bathroom, a nasty bruise on his head, and dehydrated. Those who fell asleep again said this one was different. I can't say it was the first for me. Most of them said that the first time was like someone turned the lights out, and a moment later, turned them right back on. but this go-around, people were aware of being asleep and unable to do anything about it. Mr. Carpenter told Anderson Cooper it was like he was buried deep underground and had to dig himself awake. I don't really remember much, but it didn't seem that way to me. The CDC came again, the whole CDC, it felt like. For most of the summer, I think there were more doctors than there were locals. They wandered around town in their hazmat suits, lumpy aliens probing everything they could get their mitted hands on. They were determined that there would be no mass hysteria diagnosis this time. We gave family histories, we took IQ tests, and we were screened for drugs. I heard words like idiopathic and hypersomnia. I looked them up. Idiopathic, we don't know what causes it. Hypersomnia, you get super tired. I'm no doctor, but I'm pretty sure I arrived at that diagnosis long before they did. A popular theory was that there was runoff from the meth labs out of town. Though, I saw Breaking Bad, and I don't understand how meth runoff is supposed to make us sleepy. Alex Jones said on InfoWars that there were government test subjects, that we were government test subjects, and that our water supply was being doped by the CIA. A few people tried protesting, but it was half-hearted. Honestly, Alex Jones is fucking nuts. Besides, we all knew the doctors didn't have any more of an idea of what was happening than we did. Before we knew it, it was December. By then, most of the doctors had gone back to their laboratories and hospitals, and equipment to unravel are not from the safety of their sterile rooms. The ones that remained had gotten tired of the hazmat suits and started to slowly acclimate themselves to our way of life. You'd see Dr. Fisher getting coffee at the diner, typing up her notes about an animal she dissected that morning. She'd wave and make small talk with people who stopped by her booth. And why not? She probably knew the townies better than we knew each other. We talked a lot. She's 32 and grew up in Hawaii, but lives in New York. She went to Paris twice, but speaks Spanish badly. And she's the smartest person I ever met. After Christmas, things got difficult. A few families tried to leave town and were told that they couldn't. It's just for a little while, was the not at all reassuring statement from the mayor. Around New Year's, I saw a bunch of National Guard trucks pull up to the hospital. I understand that they were just getting things ready, just for a little while. CNN, MSNBC, Bloomberg, and BBC World Service trucks pulled up to the borders of town and did recaps of the past 2 years. Fox News ran footage of the National Guard trucks by the hospital, and Sean Hannity wondered, who's paying for all of this? The taxpayers, that's who. He pissed a whole lot of the town off with that. John Oliver played the clip of a bunch of us burning a Sean Hannity doll in effigy for 3 straight weeks on his show. Each time the clip ended, he would look straight into the camera and say, delicious. The thing is, Kennedy isn't wrong. If this happens again, and to be clear, we all believe it's happening again, we're going to be entirely dependent on other people. Most of us think it's going to be longer this time, months, maybe years. If the ratio is the same between round one and round two, we're out for an average of 364 days in round three and 13 years in round four. After that, the math doesn't matter. In other news, we have our own hashtag. On the 15th of January, the National Guard started working on a barbed wire fence. No news station covered it because all the news trucks had packed up and gone home. We're good TV, but only for so long. They'll come back when we're falling asleep or waking up. We're told that the fence is there for our own protection. But I know it's because Peter Kern's family got halfway across the state before the police put out an APB. A waitress working the third shift gave them extra pie and talked their ear off about Caitlyn Jenner while waiting for a quarantine unit to arrive. That's what she said on Good Morning America anyway. The waitress is in quarantine too, but in a cushy apartment downstate. She's a hero after all. On January 30th, someone mass-mailed copies of the Robert De Niro, Robert Williams film, Awakenings. As far as jokes go, this was pretty lame. First off, no one had encephalitis, and these people aren't even asleep. They're just locked in. At the same time, I've watched the movie 6 times. It's good. Marge Simpson is in it. Which brings us to now. It's February 5th, 363 days since the last outbreak of Big Sleep. I'm at the diner with Miles. A lot of us hang out here now. Whatever time it is, it's always packed. Not too many people are keen on sleeping. If you had told me 2 years ago that this town could get any closer, I would have laughed in your face. But here we were, gabbing away like it was Sunday brunch instead of 11 p.m. on a school night. Speaking of, this should be my senior year, but I haven't been to class in 2 months. I should be planning for college, for life, and most importantly, to get the hell out of this town. 2 years ago, if you asked me what I wanted to be when I grew up, I would have said fate. Now, I've had some scraps of fame, and to hell with it, I'm full. I just want my space and my routine. I think I'm a small town kind of person after all. In the meantime, I've been reading a lot about lucid dreaming. I've been practicing, and I'm still not sure if it's total bullshit or just really hard. But I'm going to keep trying at it. My options at this point are limited. My plan is to embrace this. If I'm going to sleep, then I'm going on my terms. I'll take Jenny Sullivan to the prom and won't look like a dick. I'll take Dr. Fisher to Paris on my private jet, Air Force One. I'll have superpowers and fly and be rich and have a 1964 and a half Ford Mustang, black, with fire engine red interior. At least, I'll try. In the meantime, we wait. We drink coffee, we watch movies. The entire town is on pause until something happens one way or another. I can't tell, but I just yawned. And now I'm wondering, how tired am I?
Now, switching it up, a young girl confronts spending what's left of her youth behind bars due to a violent act. But by focusing on the recipe for her Nana's farina, she brings a bit of comfort to her prison sentence. Jim Carroll performs Breakfast with Nana in the Small Visitor's Room, written by Raquel Penzo.
So I was just wondering, having done Know You Tell It multiple times, what do you think is like unique or different about our process that makes you, like, why do you keep coming back? Like, What is it? Why haven't we scared you?
Because you guys are free editors. I get to workshop and perfect my stuff and then have it performed, then I can go home and submit it to journal. Woo!
I think that's a blurb you need to put on the website. Luckily, I prepared 2 parts to this question. So the second part is, I remember last time when we were up here on the stage, you were, somehow it came out that, I believe it was John Cusack, that you stalked.
Yes.
You stalked John Cusack. So I was wondering if there were any developments in that activity, or if you were starting, or if you were stalking someone new.
No, I still keep track of him. He's still in Malibu. I'm still here. And, we're still together.
There's nothing else to say after this. So, our second story of this evening, switching it up, we will hear Breakfast with Nana in the Small Visitor's Room, written by Raquel Penzo and performed by Jim Carroll.
Prison is not fun, but it's not what the movies say it is either. When I got moved from juvie and brought here, no one tried to fight me, or rape me, or force me to join any gangs. In fact, no one bothered to speak to me or look me in the eye. Even the guards deal with me as little as possible. No one wants anything to do with the little girl who slaughtered her stepmother like an animal, I guess. I go through a similar routine as I did before I was old enough to be brought here. Woken up too early to shower in barely warm water, and served a plain, flavorless breakfast in my cell.
where I'm served all of my flavorless meals. It gives me plenty of time to daydream about what food used to taste like and how we used to cook it, something I forced myself to do so that I'll still remember family recipes when I get out. In the late afternoon, I get about an hour of yard time, me and about five guards in a small patch of caged grass. No one says a word. I do some jumping jacks while facing the sun. I like to make believe I'm in Fort Greene Park for gym class. I used to hate outdoor gym. I was here almost 7 months before I even had a visitor. And then Nana came. She looked so sad sitting at the little square table in the middle of all the other square tables with inmates and families in the gray room surrounded by guards and cameras waiting for me to be brought in. And it made me sad to see her there. At least four doors stood between us, but the large bulletproof windows in the walls gave me a perfect view of home. Nana, in her important dress, the one she wore whenever she had to deal with Americans, an old pillbox hat and low heels. She'd even put on makeup. And it reminded me of when she stood up in front of a judge and pleaded with him not to leave us with my father after my mom died. I wanted to run and put my arms around her, but the guard escorting me was taking her sweet time both walking and then removing my restraints. Officers are under strict orders to always use restraints with me. "Ay, mija," Nana muttered. "You look so thin." "I'm okay, vieja, now that you're here. I tried to bring you some food, but those malditos out there took it away," she whispered, throwing a guard a menacing glance. "Food? What kind of food?" "My mom was a good cook, but Nana was the best. And my favorite time with her was always in the kitchen, especially in the mornings when she made huge batches of farina for the field hands who helped her on the ranch." "Necesitas algo?" Nana asked. "I was just thinking that I miss your farina. Remember, you used to make it for Marcos and those guys in the morning, remember?" "Mija, that was so long ago." "A lot of things were so long ago." Nana looked me in the face. "What do you need, Nana?" "It's cold here. Always cold. Will they let you bring me something to keep me warm?" Nana's farina was the first thing I learned how to cook. I would make it back home in Brooklyn on cold winter mornings. It warmed me up for hours. I haven't had any in so long. After Marcia moved in, I wasn't allowed to cook in my own kitchen anymore. "Ingredients. You'll need the farina brand with the little blonde boy on the box. That's the one that makes the best breakfast. Then some butter, unsalted, because Nana says it's better to season your own stuff. Never trust food that comes pre-seasoned. And never use margarine because it's gross. Salt, just a dash. Sugar, lots. Whatever lots means to you. Cinnamon, both the sticks and the ground stuff. Handfuls of raisins, any kind. Carnation milk, the kind that comes in a can and is kind of sweet. It's supposed to be diluted with water 1-to-1, but Nana always said that it was the carnation milk that helped the farina stick to your bones and get you through the day. So only add about half a can of water for every can of milk. A los Americanos le gustan cocinar con agua. That's why they're so bland as a people. We prefer spices and flavor. How are the girls? I ask. I miss my sisters as much as I miss Nana's food. They miss you. Maybe next time we will all come. I know she doesn't mean it, though. And they're so young, and middle school is already a tough enough time for a normal kid. I don't want them to see all of this and me in it. Better they stay on Nana's ranch and enjoy what's left of their childhood. What about Poppy?
Ese desgraciado. I haven't heard from him in months.
I wasn't upset about my father cutting all ties with me, but I thought he'd at least keep in touch with my sisters. I was the only one who looked like my mom, the one he couldn't bear to look at after she died. I knew he was happy not to have a reminder of his old life anymore, But I thought it was only me he hated, not my sisters. All of a sudden, I don't want to talk about it anymore. Nana, tell me, what crops did you plant this year? To make Nana's farina, first pour your milk, butter, cinnamons, raisins, sugar, and salt into a pot. Nana taught me to eyeball my ingredients. One can of carnation milk would make enough farina for about 3 or 4 people. And that's only if you're using one can. Then you probably need about 2 or 3 pats of butter, 4 cinnamon sticks, and the rest is the same as described in the ingredients list, including the salt. That's always just a dash. You'll know everything is right if, when you taste the milk base, it's sweet and creamy. You let all that simmer while stirring constantly. Have you ever boiled milk? You take your eye off of it, and you have a big old mess on your hands. So stay with the pot. Stir it slowly and purposefully. Think about the people you're about to feed and how much you care about them, how much they're going to enjoy the meal. Cook with your heart, Nina, and your food will always come out right, Nana used to say. I did everything with my heart. Only mistake I ever made was to underestimate Marcia's strength and take my eye off of her that afternoon in the basement. Things would have been neater had I not lost sight of my hand, her throat, the knife. And that's what I told the judge, too, before my sentencing. I think everything through and put my whole heart into it. And now we don't have to worry about Marcia anymore. Once the milk base starts to boil, add in the farina. Now here's where it gets tricky. You're going to need to sense how much of the grains you'll need to use. Nana used to simply pour it in from the box and know when to stop, and eventually I did too. But in the beginning, you're going to want to add in the farina little by little with a tablespoon. You'll know it's enough when you can see an almost equal amount of milk and farina, but more milk than farina. Maybe 70-30. Does that make sense? I could show you better than I could tell you. It breaks my heart to see you in here, mija. Nana started crying because the guards gave us a 5-minute warning. She flew all the way to New York City and then boarded a bus for 1,000,000 hours just to see me for 20 minutes. It took so long just to clear her through security, and now our time is almost up. It's okay, Nana. I probably won't be here that long, right? Nana sobbed a bit harder as the visitors were told it was time to go. They let us hug, and then I was pried from her arms. The judge didn't mean life for real. I probably won't be here that long. I said to myself, I guess, more than to her. She was crying too hard to hear me anyway. After you add in the farina, you keep stirring slowly and lovingly, making sure the raisins don't settle at the bottom and until the mixture gets thick but still has some runniness to it. And that's when you take the pot off the flame and let the food sit for a couple of minutes. Nana taught me that whenever you cook something, it's better to shut the flame off a few minutes before the food is actually done, because the pot, if it's a good one, keeps cooking the food for at least 5 minutes after you turn off the fire. Then you're done. Make sure everyone gets enough raisins and at least 1 cinnamon stick, and if you're feeding 6 field hands, serve it with buttered toast and some strips of bacon. The bacon makes you forget the long day ahead. The weeding, fighting the soil, dealing with stubborn cattle, the slaughter, the smell of blood that never leaves your clothes. I was brought back to my cell where no one talks to me and even the guards ignore me, where I will spend more cold nights dreaming of the warmth of the ranch. Until Nana can send me a quilt for this constant chill in my bones, I'd love to be able to work my way up to kitchen duty and make some farina for myself and the other ladies here. I'm sure they're cold too. And it would show them that I'm a nice person, that they can talk to me. And maybe I'll make some friends to pass the time until I can go home.
Thank you.
that's it. Thanks for joining us for this installment of Know You Tell It.
Visit us on the web at knowyoutellit.com.